They're asking how to go to the moon with 19th century technology. And unless you're Jules Verne, it's not on. The second thought that I had, and this would be about second, three or four of that long pause, because people ask me sometimes, so how do you make decisions? Which I'm probably the last person to ask, but they ask me. And in the context of things like government policy and so on and so forth. And what I say to them is what I do, and that is find your endpoint, whatever it is, and yours will be different than mine, and it may be similar, it may be different. If you're talking about personalization of learning, let's say that's your endpoint. Your endpoint is personalization of learning. Try to be as clear about articulating what that endpoint is, because a lot of times, especially in institutional environments, the endpoint is in fact jargon, and nobody knows what it is. So, I mean, and it's on tape, so I can say this. When I did the session in the afternoon in Adelaide, they wanted to improve collaborative mechanisms, and so I asked them. I began by asking, "Well, what's wrong with what you're doing now?" And there was no answer. They didn't know what the endpoint was, so we ended up spending basically the entire session trying to wrap our minds around the problem, because they didn't have a clear, you know, they had an idea of a solution, they wanted me to map out the solution, but they didn't have the question right. So, define the endpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Articulate it as clearly as possible, understanding that this is, in many cases, this would be your personal endpoint. Other people have their personal endpoints. Mm-hmm. There will be points of collaboration, which is great, because that's the stuff you can work together on. There will be points of difference, and you just avoid those areas. You're just going to fight about them. But as an individual, once you've defined your endpoint, then that becomes the basis for making your decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And everything you do, everything, and without exception, either leads to this endpoint or it doesn't. If it doesn't lead to the endpoint, don't do it. And if it does lead to the endpoint, do it. It sounds ridiculously simple and naive, and in a sense it is, but you have to keep in mind, because there's a whole bunch of other people out there. A lot of them are actually working toward their endpoint. They're trying to get you to do things that lead to their endpoint. And may actually draw away from your endpoint. So sometimes you have to balance how much they will help you get to where you want to go versus how far they're pushing you away from where you want to go. Because a lot of the questions that were asked today were along the lines of, well, how do I accomplish such and such in an environment where the direction is against that?
Mm.
Right. And the simple answer is you have to look at the trade-off, and you have to measure how far will they push you away versus how far will you move toward, because there's always a trade-off. And if you're in a position where the action you take pushes you further away, dig in your heel. That's where you pick your fights. And you have to pick your fights. I pick fights. I don't like fighting and things like that. And I have an end point. My endpoint is what's sitting on my webpage, the thing on the side. That's my endpoint. And everything I do leads to that endpoint. Now, I do trade-offs. So I gave Chris some business advice. That was a little facetious. But there are trade-offs. There are things that I do in my place of employment that don't lead to that endpoint. I actually sent in a patent suggestion the other day because, well, I figure if I give them a patent suggestion every once in a while, they will keep employing me, and that allows me to move closer to my endpoint. And happily, I can count on their internal mechanisms not being very good, so that they probably would never actually make it into actually being a patent, so I don't need to worry about it. But even if it did, right, it's this trade-off. So sometimes you have to give up some of what you want in order to get it. The key is find that endpoint, lock on it, never waver. And so, I know that had nothing to do with personalization and learning, but now, defining the objective, what is personalization and learning? I wrote a paper called In Practice, because I went to a conference in San Diego and met up with David Merrill. Mm-hmm. And so we had a long and interesting conversation about learner-centered learning. And it emerged that learner-centered learning meant something very different for me than for him. For me, learner-centered learning means the learner directs the learning. Mm-hmm. For him, it was the learner directs the learning, but somebody else tells him what to do. we had a great old conversation about that one. That's what I wish I had recorded. We started it the evening before and carried it on in the session. It was great and wonderful. A great, real nice person. And we had a lot in common. We differed on that. For me, learner-centered learning, personalization in learning is, in the first instance, generating the capacity for the learner to locate, choose, and use resources as determined by their own good, where mm-hmm. that is defined as them pursuing their own good in their own way. Okay, now that's the marketplace view, right? That's mm-hmm. the distributed view. Some call the marketplace view these days communism, but we'll leave that aside. It's one of these delicious ironies, right? You give power to individuals so that they can act as agents, autonomous agents in a marketplace, and that's somehow anti-marketplace. But anyhow, we'll leave that aside. So then now that has become the question of how do you present the range of learning opportunities to a person, and how do you create a mechanism where they can select from these opportunities, and how can you create an environment in which they can actually take advantage of these opportunities? Mm-hmm. And now we've got three separate questions. And now we're breaking it down into quite a bit of detail. Now the standard answer to the first question is usually the one-word answer, metadata. The long answer is what I call resource profiles. But the idea here is that there is a triad, and I need to remember this triad. It is actually on another tape, so I'm not worried that it's lost forever in history, but between the person who's using the resource itself, and the context in which the resource is used. And the idea here now is to come up with as precise a description of each of those things involving the least amount of effort put into creating that description such that you can match up a resource given a user and a context of use. I mean, in theory, you should be able to match up from any two points to get the third point. So you have a resource and a context of use, you can pick out probably who it would apply to, right? If you have a resource and a user, you can probably pick out when it would be useful. But the idea is you have these three things, because at any given point in time in a person's life, you'll have two of them. You'll have the person, and you'll have the context. And so the question now simply becomes the selection of the resource. So now we're down to the question of describing these things and the mechanisms for producing descriptions of these things. And now we're going to move to a very sub-level sort of thing where we're talking about generating a system whereby metadata, whatever that means, is generated for each of these three things: the person, the resource, and the context, in an automated way such that this metadata can be retrieved by any entity in the network at any time, because otherwise it's useless. And so when I talk about a lot of stuff, I talk a lot about the resource metadata in particular, mm-hmm. which is what Resource Profiles is itself about. And to make a very long story short, what we want to do is generate data about this resource as it is created and used, not as a separate process. And in the Resource Profiles paper, I identified three major types of metadata that would describe this resource. And as an aside, those three types of metadata can also be applied to people and can also be applied to context. So the three types of metadata I call first-party, second-party, and third-party metadata. First-party metadata about a resource is authored by the creator of that resource. It's the bibliographic metadata, author, title, and so on. It's the kind of metadata that's produced by Blogger when you create a blog entry. Right, so this metadata is created automatically by the system in the process of creating a resource. Second type of metadata is called second-party metadata. It is metadata created by the user at the time of use. And more accurately, is created by the environment in which the user uses the resource at the time of use. It would include, for example, the context of use. This person looked at this picture inside a history class, and therefore part of the description of that resource is it was used in a history class. And that leads to the suggestion that maybe, just maybe, it's a history resource. Now, it's not only a history resource. We used it in a wide variety of applications, but it's at least partially a history resource because it was used in a history class. And then finally, third-party metadata is metadata that's created by people who are neither the producers nor the users of the object. They are therefore neutral third-party observers. Typical examples of third-party metadata would be the classification of a resource by a librarian. See, the librarians are back. because they are experts in classification, the consistent application of classification schemas. Siskel and Ebert produced classic third-party metadata. They used a very simple metadata schema. Two thumbs up, two thumbs down, or one of each. Three-part metadata. And any sort of evaluative metadata. Evaluative classification, any sort of way of describing this from a third-party perspective. So you have your metadata about the object, you have your metadata about the context, you have your metadata about the person, and again, I can talk about the creation of personal metadata. That's much less well-developed out there now than resource metadata. I don't know why, but it is. All this talk about profiles is a tentative first step, not necessarily in the right direction, but with the right, or, no, in the right direction, but not necessarily with the right objective. In the world of RSS, there's a thing called FOF, friend of a friend, which again is person metadata. So you have these three sets of metadata, and these sets of metadata, how do I want to put this? Because the dominant model, the dominant paradigm that we use is a just-in-time search kind of model, right? Mm-hmm. You need to find something, you go to Google. But when we know all of this stuff ahead of time, which we do, then these can become, should become, will become parameters for the design of the network that connects you and your resource. I can't do it in the time that I have without some dramatic hand waving.
And time is running out.
But the idea is there is a network of interconnections between the producers of the resource and the consumer of the resource in the context. And this network is constituted of a variety of intermediaries. And the metadata describing each of the components of that network feed into the network and actually design the construction of that network. They inform the construction of that network. And in fact, as the metadata changes, the structure of the network itself changes. Simple example, part of the network might be an RSS aggregator, and as your interests change, the set of RSS aggregators that your system uses may change.
Mm-hmm.
So that you access different RSS aggregators at different times. So you think of there is an intermediary network, and then we finally get to the presentation and use of the resource. And the idea is, in a context of use, any context of use, a fishing rod, strawberry jam, a learning object browser, whatever, that actually forms the top end, the surface, if you will, of the network that I've just described. All of these connections are already in place. When you go to search for something, the search has already taken place, and the results are present in the current construction of the network. And all you need to do is ask for it. And depending on your options, 1, 2, or 100 highest quality results will be produced for you, given the context of what it is that you're up to at a given time. That's how personalization works.
Thank you for that. We've got time for one last question, and I was going to ask Stephen Brain to pose this question to Stephen, and then I need a couple of minutes to wrap up, but you may have had most of that up.
I think I have had most of it answered. It's not as though you're just handing everything over to Google style search with a bunch of RSS feeds to rely on what's useful as a learning object and what isn't. It's a lot more complex than that.
It's a lot more complex than that.
Cool.
But the irony is, it's a lot more complex than that, but none of the pieces are as complex as Windows. The pieces are simple. It works because the components of this thing are simple. And in fact, almost the simpler each component is, the better it will work. And there are ways I can explain that. There's even mathematics to support that. But the thing is, the more complex any entity in the system, any entity of this network is, the more likely it is that the network will produce invalid results.